Questions being raised with regard to what we discussed, that essentially Judaism is a religion which appeals to our mind, that the most fundamental avenue of human perfection is through knowledge. Of course, as we say many times, it's not just that a person should be an intellectual. We have a certain specific idea of what we mean when we talk about knowledge, knowledge of the good. But the person has to relate to the knowledge in a certain way, that this becomes reality for him. So when these truths become incorporated as part of his sense of reality, so then and the person lives his life in accordance with these truths, so that's the real perfection of man. And he redirects all of his instinctual energies towards that which is true. So in order for a person to perfect himself, to achieve the objective of the Torah insofar as human existence is concerned, the person has to use their mind. And that's obvious in every aspect of the Torah, that the Torah exhorts us to study the commandments and to observe them properly. The whole system is based upon the idea that study of Torah, Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam, and the greater the individual, the greater that person's understanding. The gateway to perfection is through knowledge and understanding. That's basically what I was saying yesterday. And in order to do so, in order to achieve knowledge, a person has to study and listen to opinions. That's part of the process. But in doing so, it's impossible to gain anything from any authority unless you scrutinize it, unless you analyze it, unless you question it. To just simply accept it is not even knowledge. It doesn't really make an impression on you. That goes without saying. Now the questions being raised with regard to the Akedah, the test of Avraham. And there we say that Avraham did not question. Even in the case of Avraham, for example, we see the desire for understanding is clearly manifested, for example, in the case of Sodom and Amorah, when he steps forward and, so to speak, engages in a dialogue or a debate, questions God's premises. That itself shows you that even in a situation when God informs him of what he's going to do, so he responds by questioning. That should be the ultimate example. That even God is telling him that this is just, and still he doesn't just accept it without questioning it. The Akedah, however, is a different phenomenon. And the objective over there was not something that would have to do with the acquisition of some kind of a knowledge. It's a perfection that a person attains in terms of their relationship to God, their trust in God, their love of God. As the pasuk makes it clear, that this was a test to see whether Avraham truly had fear of God. So it says afterwards, Ata yadati, now I know, ki yirei Elokim ata, that you fear God, v'lo chasachta es bincha es yichidcha mimeno. And that you did not withhold your only son from God. So this is a test of Avraham. The Rambam talks about it, the whole purpose of tests, whether the purpose of tests is to give the person an opportunity to reach a higher level, that's the Ramban, or whether it's to demonstrate. According to the Rambam, it's not to give the person a chance to reach a higher level, but rather it's to serve as an illustration for mankind, that mankind should recognize a certain ideal. So the ideal that's involved over here, according to the Rambam, actually, there are two. One is with regard to the ultimate degree of perfection in terms of a person's love of God and fear of God, which means that the ultimate value that a person has, the ultimate love that a person has, is not that which is directed towards other relationships, but to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the idea of the love of God. And the Rambam describes this at great length in the 10th chapter of the Tshuva, where he talks about the highest possible level of perfection that a person is capable of reaching. And he says over there that even not all great people can reach this level. Even great Torah scholars do not necessarily attain this level, because it's a transformation of all the energies of a person, and the motivating principle in everything that they do is the love of God. And it's something that consumes them. And he compares it to a tremendous passion. When a person is romantically in love with a member of the opposite sex, whether a man's in love with a woman is in love with a man. But when we're talking about in love over here, we're talking about the kind of emotion that you experience at the height of the whole romantic encounter. Because as we know, that after a while, that type of emotion wears off. And while you still love the person, it's a different kind of relationship. Everybody remembers when they fell in love and they were completely smitten with the other person. And it puts you in a different kind of state. And you can't stop thinking about it. And you're fully consumed with it. And everything you do is determined by it. Therefore, no task is too difficult. Whatever the person wants you to do, you're going to do. Things that you normally wouldn't want to do, getting up at 3 a.m. and undertaking the, you know, most arduous kinds of tasks, become an easy thing to do, because what you have really in mind is that this is binding you to the one that you love. So that's a powerful motivating force. So that's what the Rambam describes in Tshuva as being the ultimate level, that the person, that this is a more powerful emotion, that the person can't remove themselves from their complete involvement in the love of God. And the other side of the coin, to which this is very closely connected, is a certain awe, the awesomeness of God. Therefore, the Akedah was by its very nature something which really didn't lend itself to the kind of questioning and analysis. The questioning, the analysis, the learning, the knowledge brings a person to a certain level. It brings a person to a certain relationship to God. At which point in time, all of their energies are directed towards God. God is the only reality. And therefore, when God commands something, even if this should go contrary to every other matter of importance, to every attachment that the person has, to everything of concern, it pales, it evaporates in the face of the true love, the underlying love that motivates the person. So that's what the Akedah is really about. And there was nothing to question over here. This has to do with the will of God, as opposed to the situation of Sodom and Amorah, which was justice. So when God manifested himself to Abraham in the situation of Sodom to inform him of what he intended to do, it was clear that this was implementing a category of justice. And justice is something that man has to relate to, and man needs to understand how justice works to the greatest extent possible. Indeed, that was the entire purpose. He wasn't commanding Avram to do anything in that situation. Rather, he was communicating, and the purpose of the communication was to increase his understanding. Also, to give him the opportunity to respond with prayer. That's an element of compassion. But that was clearly within the framework of those things that a person ought to understand. There it shows the greatness of Abraham, that he didn't just accept it. And that proves the point. Because if a person is merely supposed to accept without knowing, without understanding, certainly in a situation where God is the source, when you're dealing with people, so no person is infallible. It's another reason why this approach today to just accept authorities without questioning them is wrong, because it's presuming some type of an infallibility in people, that people, we don't maintain that any person is infallible, and that there's a person that could ever be a person whose every opinion would have to be correct. That partakes of some type of a deification of people. It's just not true. However, if you're going to talk about infallibility, of course, God, so to speak, I don't even want to use the word infallible. God is perfect. Thus, if one is receiving an opinion from God, one can't imagine that there might be something wrong with it, that you could criticize it. Nevertheless, Avraham argues, not because there's a premise that God may be mistaken, but rather because even though you know that it's true, but that truth is not of value to you unless you understand the idea and why it's true and what that truth is. So that substantiates my point that the value of Torah in terms of perfecting a person is insofar as the person gains understanding of it. However, once a person reaches a certain level of conviction about the Torah, conviction about God, that doesn't mean to say that obedience in every situation is going to be dependent upon your understanding. That's something else. Now it could be a test of one's faith in God. When it comes to a test of one's faith in God, faith is an area where you don't really understand in specific cases why God is doing this or why God is doing the other thing. But nevertheless, Kela Muna V'yeinovel Tzadik V'yoshahu, that we relate to God as perfect in justice, which means to say that that's because of our fundamental conviction about the reality of God. However, in specific cases, we can't prove, we can't see how the justice is expressing itself. That's the situation that Avraham was in. The situation with regard to Yitzhak had nothing to do with justice. It wasn't a matter of a punishment of any kind whatsoever. It was simply God declaring that this is his will. Thus, it would be a test of one's entire relationship to God. If one views God as being the ultimate reality and a being who is perfect, of course, we recognize that we're created beings. And there's no way that we can scrutinize the will of God. We can understand. There's a limited amount that we can understand. So that was the test of Avraham. It didn't call for that type of a phenomenon to explain to him how this makes a sense. That's why the whole essence of the test was to see whether he had the capability of complying with it, whether he could sacrifice the most prized possession that he had for the sake of fulfilling the command of God. I was studying Bahar, chapter 25, verse 35. One of the main concerns of the Sedra is the treatment of the poor. That's incorporated in the idea of Shemitah, which is that a person tills the field for 6 years, and on the seventh year, the field lies fallow. The person can't work the field for commercial purposes. He's permitted to eat from the fruits, but he really does not have any particular ownership, rights of ownership, over anybody else. The field is open for everyone. Anyone can come and eat, and that would include even animals. So that's it's called the Shemitah. It's called the Shabbos. It's akin to Shabbos. And then, after seven of those cycles, you have what's called the Yovel, the Jubilee year. So let's just see if we can get a general idea. What's the concept behind that? What's the general concept of Shemitah? Yeah, the Shemitah is an extension of the idea of Shabbos. But Shabbos too, it says that 6 days shall you work, and on the seventh day you shall rest. The same is true with regard to the years, tilling of the soil. Tilling of the soil has to do with the idea of ownership. On the one hand, the Torah respects the concept of ownership. There's many tractates of the Gemara that deals with the whole idea of ownership and the obligations we have not to steal, to return lost objects. At what point in time does a person lose ownership? That's the concept of yush. If a person lost their object and it's in a situation where they give up hope, and so forth. So the Torah is very meticulous about the concept of ownership, and you're not allowed to tread upon that which belongs to somebody else. This on the surface might seem to be contradictory, because here it seems to be contrary to the idea of ownership. The Shemitah seems to be uprooting the whole idea of ownership. But in general, the society is founded upon respect for private property, which is based upon a person's rights of ownership. It would seem that there's a certain ambivalence over here. I would like to see if we can clarify what's the true formulation of the idea of ownership. On the surface, it seems to be something which really strikes a blow to a person's sense of ownership. Because when a person is an owner, it's his, and he's involved in it, and he wants to be able to utilize it to make plans, to be innovative, to be successful with it. The law of the Torah comes around and just, that's it. You got to stop whatever you were planning to do. I'll give you an analogy. Someone is an artist, they're working on something. So this preoccupies them. So they get up in the morning, they make up in the middle of the night, they have a new idea, they want to try something out, they make a change, they're completely immersed in it. So imagine telling an artist that there are times you can't go near the painting. It strikes at the relationship that exists between the artist and their handiwork. Same thing with an owner, a businessman. Whenever he has an idea, he's completely submerged. He wants to be able to implement it. That's why he becomes an owner. Very often a person goes into business on their own precisely because they feel stifled. They're working for somebody else, and they thought they'd have more freedom to do what they want to do, and they see they can't, because they don't have the power, so then they finally decide to open up their own studio or their own business, and they have the right to make the decisions. That's what people strive for. We should really try and analyze that there is an emotion, a very powerful emotion in man, which has to do with acquisition, with ownership. You see that that's the case. That when a person sees something that they like, they relate to it in a certain way. It's not practical. Owning something satisfies a different emotion in man. That is, even if you could have access to something, it's not just practical. Sometimes you'll buy something because it's impractical to go to the gym all the time. You need it in your house, things of that sort. But then there are times where a person will see something and they'll say, I have to have that. They have to own it. And when they own it, they feel a certain satisfaction. And it's really not that related to how much they use it or don't use it. It's not a practical thing. It's a certain kind of an emotion. I think we can all relate to that. Sometimes when you're feeling down, you need a pick-me-up. You go out, you buy something. But I don't mean just in a trivial sense. It's a person buys a house, they own a house. Gives them a certain feeling. That's a tremendous milestone in a person's life. And it's not necessarily related to the practicalities. Because you can rent. And there's no danger that if you didn't buy the house, you wouldn't be able to rent. but there's a completely different emotion. So let's see if we can understand that. It has to do with a person's fantasy of immortality. It has to do with security. When a person owns something, it increases their sense of security. And especially when you get to the types of things that are prominent, that conjure up the sense of permanence, like a house, a mansion. That's why there's this urge. As people get more wealth, they're not content to buy something which would have been very luxurious when they were not as wealthy. A great mansion, a palace. It conjures up a certain sense of immortality, of permanence. Somehow or other, a person associates himself with the object, and the object conveys a certain sense of security and permanence. The sense of security and permanence is connected to buying significant objects. As opposed, I mean, the emotion operates with lesser objects as well. If a person sees a beautiful dress, they're not content to merely be able to use it, to rent it or to lease it. They want to own it. They want to have it. So the emotion crops up even with lesser objects, but insofar as it's connected with the security, so objects of greater significance. If a person gets a luxury car, a beautiful car, it conveys a certain emotion. And certainly when you're talking about things like a house, things of that sort, property is significant. That's why you see that the institution of Shemitah has to do with land, because perhaps of all the different things that a person acquires, and which through the acquisition conveys the greatest sense of security. And one would have to say, I guess it's a false sense of security. The emotion that it conveys is not in line with the reality. It is land. Land is the biggest attraction of all. Indeed, most of the wars in history are fought over territory, land. And there too, there may be practicalities, but the psychological phenomenon is the most significant. If a person acquires a lot of land, it's another factor. How much land did the house come with? A person buys an island. Today there are wealthy people. So this is a tremendous source of security. Question is whether the emotion of ownership that a person has is based on any kind of reality. And the idea of Shabbos conveys a fundamental principle, which I think is the fundamental idea of our relationship to God and the true fear of God, which is to say that we really don't own anything. If a person would look at it, as it says in Pirkei Avos, mentioned in the fourth chapter, that Bal Karchach Ata Chai and Bal Karchach Ata Meis, that is, it's against, so literally against your will. That is, a person has absolutely no control over anything, because you don't even have control over your own existence. People are always looking to control things. And you see how a person is looking to position himself to be able to sustain his own existence, to pretend as though he really has control over the scheme of things. But he has very little control, because the whole foundation is one which you had nothing to do with. You don't really own anything. You don't even own your own existence. Because existence is not a part of your essence at all. It's an accident, as far as you're concerned. Which means to say that if you think in terms of the ultimate reality, there's only God. And everything else that exists doesn't have real existence. There's nothing that's true. There's nothing that has any real existence except for God. And everything exists only because of the will of God. So it's a very contingent type of a phenomenon. The attitude that a person has is completely different. The person acts as though he's responsible for his own existence. He's the cause of his own existence, or his existence doesn't require a cause. He just exists. He exists because of himself. He finds the cause of his existence within himself because of his unique characteristics and because he's special. And that's why he exists. All right, so he'll recognize his parents and grandparents. That's just a means, whatever. That doesn't have any real significance for him. I was using the analogy, from an emotional standpoint, our relationship, the way we behave, the way we manifest ourselves, can be compared to, you ever see a puppet with a good ventriloquist? The whole objective of the ventriloquist is to make it look like the puppet is real. And the more skillful he is, the more that's conveyed. It's amazing. If you didn't know differently, it looks like it has a personality of its own. But sometimes they make a joke of it. That becomes the joke, that the puppet is acting as though he's the master and he's making fun out of the ventriloquist. That's what because humorous, because you know the truth, you know how absurd that is. But because there is no puppet. The puppet doesn't have any personality. It's just expressing whatever it is that's being fed into it by the ventriloquist. I'm not saying the situation is identical over here, but you see, in terms of the dependency, that it doesn't have any real existence on its own, and to just go and chart its own course as though this is its world, this is my place, it's my world, and I could do whatever I want with it, that idea of autonomy that people have, and it's expressed, it's my life, it's my body, I can do whatever I want with it. That's the prevailing philosophy of today, which is based upon the idea that man is autonomous, and this is his world, and he decides. That's a complete denial of God. And it's totally absurd, because you don't have any autonomy. You don't have any basis, any foundation of existence. The whole reason for your existence is purely contingent. It's only insofar as God's will relates to you. And if God should withdraw his will from you, as happens in the case of the marble, for example, the flood, so then you're no different than the puppet. In terms of the basis for existence, which if you did have a basis for existence, if this was truly yours, then there'd be something called autonomy. You decide. You'd be the one to make up the rules. But this is not true in terms of the nature of our existence. That's why we have to alter our complete attitude towards existence and towards ownership. Because everything belongs to God, who created it. However, in the framework of our reality, of our society, we have to live in accordance with the system. So the system that God has mandated is one in which you have to recognize who has the right. Ownership over here, you have to differentiate between the true meaning of ownership and the emotion of ownership. The true meaning of ownership means that you have certain rights to use the object within the framework of the system of law, which is the halachic system. But you don't really have the ownership that your emotions I think you have. That's why there comes the seventh year, that's a real blow to the emotion of ownership. It's a blow to the narcissism that a person has to realize that it never really belonged to him. That's the whole point. If it belongs to you and it's truly yours, then nobody can tell you what to do with it. All right, let's assume you're not hurting anybody. I'm not getting into that. But if it's truly yours, that's the idea. The idea that it's yours means I alone determine the fate of this thing. It's completely mine and nobody can tell me what to do with this. That's what a person wants. And the Shemitah tells you that that's not the case. That that's a false idea and nothing really belongs to you at all. Your own life doesn't belong to you. You exist only by virtue of the will of God. And God allows you to use his objects in order to achieve a certain purpose. And by refraining, just like on the seventh day you refrain, 6 days you're involved in the physical aspect of existence. And on the seventh day you refrain. Because a person shouldn't make a mistake and think that involvement in the physical aspect is the purpose. A person lives in two dimensions. That is, there are activities that you're involved in, not because that's the purpose of your existence. A person has to be able to define, to isolate what is the purpose of his existence. Man is the only creature that has to be involved in that and that has to have correct knowledge of that. Because everything was created for a purpose. So human existence has a purpose. The only thing is that it's not going to come about naturally. Man is the only creature who can thwart his purpose, who can establish goals for himself which are not in line with his true purpose. That's why man has to have knowledge of his purpose. However, in order to achieve his purpose, he has to sustain himself. So he has to be involved in two sets of activities, the means and the ends. Those activities that are geared towards securing the means for his existence, and those activities that are for the sake of the purpose. Unfortunately, most people distort the picture. And the biggest mistake is that they take activities which are relevant only to the means, and they somehow allow the means to become an end in itself. So the idea of Shabbos is that a day is set aside to convey this idea that if you want to know the true purpose of your existence, it's founded upon the idea of creation, that you're a created being. And when a person recognizes that, he recognizes the Creator, and that he has within himself an element which partakes of something that's outside the realm of the physical, the divine soul. So that's the purpose, to fulfill his potential as a being who can use his intelligence to recognize and relate to God. That's the same idea with the Shemitah, that teaches you that there's no such thing as true ownership. The only ownership is the ownership of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the ownership that we have is so that we have the rights. It's a system. We have to operate. You can't have a society unless there's an order. There has to be an order so people can have a society. But the real objective in the acquisition should be to utilize it as a means to an end. So that's the idea of Shemitah. The same idea that the number 7 over here is a very significant number, not because numbers have any magical properties, but it recalls the concept of creation. That the God brought the world into existence in 6 days, and on the seventh day desisted, so to speak. So that's the idea of Shabbos every week with regard to this institution of property in the society. So that's the same idea, 6 years, and then the seventh year it lies fallow. That's the same idea of Shabbos applied to a different arena of human existence. And that's very significant because it breaks down the human narcissism, that a person realizes that he's nothing special, that there's nothing really about him that's special. That's the biggest enemy of perfection, the feeling that I'm special. And because I'm special, I own things. There are different things that a person does and acquires in order to magnify that sense of being special, of being important. Here, he loses all of his rights of ownership. And anybody can come into the field. And the most significant aspect of Shemitah, as far as this idea of humbleness affects him on a practical level, has to do with the poor, with the ani. That is the recognition that he's no different, that for all of his acquisitions, for all of his ownership, it does not create any feeling of superiority. I mean, any reality. Maybe a feeling it does create. And that's the biggest problem of wealth from a spiritual point of view, is that it creates a false sense of superiority. The whole purpose that people pursue wealth is to feel that superiority. That's why it's all relative and it's all measured. And there's different categories. There's middle class, upper class, wealthy, millionaires, multimillionaires, billionaires. It's all a matter of trying to feel superior. And there's two things wrong with it. One is that it doesn't make you superior. The whole idea of being superior is absurd to begin with. The concept of being superior is an absurd concept. And that's something we should really try and uproot from our psyche. Much of the impetus, the drive of people to do things is to enable them to feel superior, superior to someone. That is a complete distortion. Secondly, even if one does partake of it, it's absurd because it has nothing to do, the amount of money that a person has absolutely nothing to do with questions of superiority and inferiority. So thus, a person in Shemitah has to acknowledge that he really doesn't have any superiority. He doesn't have any superiority over the Ani. That the poor person, the Ani, because he doesn't have physical possessions, that in no way, shape, or form makes him any inferior. To the contrary, Chazal say that we should be careful. Be careful about the Aniyim, because Me'aniyah Yisrael, Yisei Soro. That if you want to know from which class, socioeconomic strata, the Torah scholars come from, generally speaking, it comes from the poor. Because luxuries in general, the pursuit of ease and luxuries and wealth, which essentially is what we call mosros, unnecessaries, by and large are not beneficial to a person spiritually. Because it only makes the person more entrenched in the physical, in the arena of the fantasies, the unreal. And it doesn't have a good effect upon the person because it makes the person lazy. Spiritually, the person becomes very lazy. Because they have no need, it removes a tremendous impetus to utilize their energies in the pursuit of what's real. There's a certain resistance towards galvanizing one's energies in study. A certain resistance to study. A person is drawn after the fantasies, and study, at least at the outset, takes a lot of energy, and it's difficult, and you have to concentrate, and a person wants quick gratification, instant gratification. So the Aniyim, however, precisely because of the fact, that it's painful, there's a certain amount of pain involved in it, and they don't have access to all of the easier pleasures, so this is the only thing they have left. In order to find meaning in their lives, in order to have a sense of self-worth, they have no choice but to engage in the arena of Torah. Now, of course, you'll say, but that's a lo lishma. That is to say that they're not really learning for the true sake of learning. It's due to the situation. That is true, but it means to say that that situation in and of itself is beneficial in terms of a person's spiritual development. However, a person tends to look down on the Ani. A person tends to look down on the Ani, even if you're kind to the Ani, there's a certain patronizing attitude that people have, if they're going to be honest about that. And that is that they regard the Ani as being inferior, partaking of an inferior level of existence. And they feel sympathy for the Ani, and they want to help the Ani because it makes them feel like they're good, that, you know, you're a bigger person, you're helping the little person, so to speak. Let's take a look now at Chaf Hei, 25, Lamed Hei, which is very interesting. Let's read it through. It says, V'chiyama chachicha. If your brother becomes impoverished. But it's interesting. It doesn't mean that that the person is poor at this point. Umata yada imach. And he's beginning to falter, so to speak. V'chazakta bo, and you should support him. Ger v'toshav v'chaimach. Whether the person be a ger, or a resident, or a convert, he can live with you. So what's the pasuk conveying over here? What does it mean v'hechazakta bo? What does it mean umota yodo imach? That he's somehow or other beginning to falter. It's not talking about a person that's poor yet. It's interesting. It's a person who right now is not poor, but he's going through a spiral, a downward spiral. He's fallen on hard times, and if things continue as they are, he will be poor. So what's being conveyed over here? The basic idea seems to be that you're supposed to help your brother. And when are you supposed to help your brother? When he's poor. So what is it citing for our purposes, someone who's not yet poor, but seems that he's headed in that direction? Then it says, Al tikach meito neshech v'sarbis. It warns you not to take any interest from this person. And you shall fear God and let your brother live with you. And then you're not allowed to give your money, lend your money with interest. Or any type of increase. And you shall fear the Lord your God. That's an important v'yireisim elokech, you shall fear God. And then it says that I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan to be your God. What's the main idea over here? The main idea seems to be that you're supposed to come to the aid of your brother in need. That's tzedakah. And of course, warning you not to take any advantage of this person's plight. That's what basically what interest is about. That another person has fallen on hard times, needs help, and you can utilize that as an opportunity to enrich yourself at his expense, making it worse for him, because he's desperate. So a person is desperate, they'll take any money to they alleviate the immediate situation, put some food on the table, and therefore they have no choice, they'll accept the interest. But then if just they can't make the payment, so it piles on, and it makes the situation even worse. So that's why interest is prohibited. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, "Vechazakta bo," that you should strengthen him. This is a special category that the Torah is referring us to. So Rashi says, do not allow him to fall. Don't allow him to go down further and fall. And then it'll be difficult to raise him up. But rather strengthen him from the time when he starts to falter. That's the time to get in there. That's the time to strengthen him. Don't let him fall. What is that to be compared to? That an ox, for example, is carrying a heavy load. And sometimes you could tell that it's about to fall. So while it's still on the animal, so one person can hold on to it and keep it there. It's much, much easier to keep it in place. But once it falls to the ground, then even five people can't replace it. That's what Rashi is saying. So what's the analogy? The analogy is that when it comes to helping a person, if you step in, so-called early intervention, seems to be a commercial promotion of the idea of early intervention. If you intervene early and prevent the damage it's much easier to control. On the other hand, if you wait until the damage is complete, so then it's much, much harder to put together again. That's what Rashi seems to be saying. This is an interesting lesson in its own right. I think everybody knows that. That we tend to be lazy. And I guess in every area, whether it's your property, whether it's taking care of obligations, or even people even with your health. People are reluctant. They don't want to go to the dentist. They keep overlooking something. Had they gone immediately, it would have been a simple matter. But because of their negligence, they finally have no choice. They have to go. And then it's much, much harder. I think we've all had this experience in some area, whether it can be with your property. There's a leak somewhere. There's a problem. Or with your car. So you people are lazy. Oh, it'll go away. You ignore it. Whatever. Of course, it gets worse and worse and worse. And then you bring it in, you had a major problem. Had you brought it in immediately, it would have been nothing. So that's almost a Roskill. In early intervention. It's a Musa Haskell. It's something that we should all be cognizant of. As I said, I believe that everybody's had that experience in certain areas, and then you always vow that next time you're going to take care of it immediately and not allow it to come to this pass. And sometimes you learn the lesson, sometimes you don't, or then it could be in different areas and you go through the same kind of thing again. I guess sometimes a person has an experience where you get a ticket, a parking ticket, whatever it is, and you're too lazy to send it in, and then it keeps building up. I mean, a lot of people have that. No, they have many tickets, and it eventually becomes a real problem. You may not be able to renew your license. We all have that. My question is, that's true over here. The example that Rashi gives with the ox is true. Don't let it fall down. Prevent it from falling down. Because once it falls down, you got a whole new problem. But isn't that practical advice? Which everybody's aware of that. I think there's a popular saying, a stitch in time saves nine, something like that. This type of thing. What we've just learned is true, and it's good advice, but do we need the Torah for that? I mean, that's the whole point that's being made. So thus, the Torah sees the case and told you that you may encounter people before they become poor. And sometimes you can spot that moment in time when they're beginning to fall, and that's the time to intervene. Okay, is that the idea, just the practicality of it, that early intervention will make it easier? So in other words, it's a utilitarian concept. It'll make it easier for yourself. If you step in now, it'll be easier in the long run. Is that the idea, or is there something else here? The point is, it's true that it's not just good advice, it's an obligation. The Rambam lists different categories with regard to the mitzvah of tzedakah. And the highest level is where you help a person to get a job, thereby preventing him from becoming an oni in the first place. That's the highest level. It's interesting that the mitzvah of tzedakah is subject to different levels. We should try and understand that. The highest level is not to actually have to give tzedakah, to prevent that situation from ever developing. So it's being suggested that a reason for that is that it's a very devastating emotional experience for a person to be in that situation. Even though we said that it has spiritual benefits, possible spiritual benefits, that if a person is impoverished, has nothing else, might use that as an opportunity, a springboard, to get involved in greater Torah study. However, it's very possible that the person will feel completely humiliated. And the whole sense of self-esteem can be broken down, and it could have that effect as well. The objective of the Torah is to prevent the person from having to go through such a devastating experience, psychological experience. That's what we pray in the Birkat HaMazon. That we should never be dependent upon people. We shouldn't be aniyim. We should never be dependent upon matnas basav adam, the gift of charity of people. So that's why in giving tzedakah, it's not merely for the benefit of the other person. As we said, there are mitzvos which are essentially designed between man and others, essentially designed to help the other person, to help the society. That's true over here, but it's also in terms of your own perfection. Performing the mitzvah of tzedakah is a vital element in one's perfection. And how one performs it, even if you wind up giving tzedakah, how you perform it is extremely important. You see that in the case of tzedakah. For example, the pasuk warns you that when you give, you shouldn't feel a certain attitude towards it. You shouldn't be upset within your heart. A lot of times a person really is in a conflict. It bothers them very much, but they have no choice. They give. Here the Torah is warning you not to feel that way. And in fact, the Ramban says that if you give tzedakah, and while you're giving it really bothers you in your heart, you're really upset with the whole thing, so then that's a yavera. It's a los aseh. He counts it as a los aseh, as a negative command. So you see that how a person performs the mitzvah of tzedakah is vital. The perfection has to do with many things, but what's being pointed out over here, I believe, is that this is unique. It's easy to overlook the situation at this point in time. The person at this point in time is not yet branded as an ani. So you can turn away. Look, he's not an ani yet. We'll see what happens later on. Right now, he's okay. True, he's having a tough time. Maybe he'll pull out of it. So it's easier to deny. But I want to maintain that perhaps there's something else. I'm just going to throw it out as a suggestion. This requires tremendous sensitivity to the needs of the other person. To help a person in this at this particular point, where he's not yet dependent, where he's not yet an ani, but where he's, for all intents and purposes, he's still standing on his feet. That requires a certain type of perfection and sensitivity to the dignity of the other person. And there's something that's lacking over here. When you give to a poor person, there's many emotions over there. First of all, there is a certain satisfaction that people have that no matter how bad things are, you see others have it worse. That's something that people will refer to. And sometimes when someone's suffering, you say, look, okay, but look at the other one. You'll point out the other one. If compared to them, your situation isn't that bad. And sometimes the person will hear it. Sometimes they won't. But I think everybody partakes of that. And the ani, if you're not an ani, even if you have your own difficulties, and so forth, but you look at an ani, and it makes you feel, at least I'm not an ani, makes you feel a little bit better. So you feel a certain sense of superiority. And indeed, that's why you give. There is a certain sadistic element there that could be activated. On a certain level, you could be happy that this person is suffering. We have to be honest about that. I mentioned this many times, that there is a certain satisfaction in witnessing the suffering of others. At the same time, you may be feeling appalled by it, but on a certain unconscious level, or maybe not so unconscious. I've pointed out many times, there's a tremendous attraction. People have to be at the scene of an accident, a crash. It clogs up the roads for miles. People are dying to have a look at it. Of course, when they see it, and then they feel guilt, of course, and they have to say how terrible and horrible it is, but why do you have to see it in the first place? So it does cater to that. And then, when you give to the poor person, you feel good about yourself. You feel like you're a benefactor. And generally speaking, the poor person looks to you. You helped him. You have that feeling that you helped him. See, a person should never have that feeling that you helped him. That's part of the idea of Shemitah. that it's not really that you helped him, and it's not even really that you gave him anything of yours. All you did was transfer something which belongs to God. That's the true idea. It's not yours. God enabled you, God entrusted you, so to speak. I'll give you an example. Remember when we were little kids, going to yeshiva, first grade, second grade, whatever. So my parents would always give, I don't remember, small amounts, and especially in those days, maybe a nickel, whatever, a few pennies, to give to the tzedakah, to give to the pushka. Because they wanted to train us in giving tzedakah. So whatever, you'd get, a few cents to buy a snack with, whatever, and then there was the tzedakah money. So it would be absurd for the child. Of course, we're not going to analyze the child, but I mean, you could see that in such a situation, or now as an adult, if you're just a shliach, so to speak, if somebody appoints you to be a shliach and gives you $10 and asks you to give it to a certain ani. So sometimes the ani will show all the gratitude to you. And interestingly enough, sometimes you'll actually feel good. That's how the emotions can distort things and the mind can play games. The reality is, you're not the giver. You're just transferring it. It's somebody else is the giver. That's the idea that a person should have when they're giving tzedakah, that it's God. God gave it to you, gave you the opportunity to use this to help that person, but it's really from God. So you're not the benefactor. Nevertheless, we do have that emotion. So there is a complete difference. It's much more difficult to give in this situation to prevent the person from becoming an ani, because on a certain level, you like the fact that the person is becoming an ani. When the person is an ani, then it makes you feel good. A, that he's worse off than you. B, that you're superior. And you're actually helping him. You're a good person. You're a wonderful person. But to look into the situation, the true concern for the dignity of people, to look into the situation, to come to somebody's assistance, and to prevent that person from becoming an ani, which you'll never be able to have these feelings and these emotions, because he's never an ani. He's never going to look at you as a benefactor in that way. That is the true mitzvah of tzedakah. Where all the other emotional factors are gone, it's not just a practical thing. The practical thing we know. But people aren't motivated in this area to be practical. People want to be reactive in this area. You come upon a person who's suffering, so it brings out many emotions within you. Some of cruelty, some of sympathy. And then the resolution, you give, so you're a good person, you're a great person. Look what you did. But to intervene when none of these factors are present, to actually prevent it from occurring, and not ever earning that kind of gratitude, because the person may not be in that frame of mind. He may not even recognize that he's about to go down. And he may not even admit it, because people tend to deny these things. The person will always say, that year was a little bit rough, but thank God I pulled out of it. He may not... You won't have that same sense of gratitude from the person. The whole dynamics is different. That's where the true mitzvah, the chayachicha imach, that you regard this person as a brother, that you do not regard yourself as being superior. You remove that whole emotion of superiority, which is intimately connected towards the acquisition of goods. That, I think, is the idea of the parasha, and very fundamental to the whole theme of Shemitah.